It's time now for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campomanosi, President of the Common Sense Campaign and Adjunct Professor of Political Science at Spring Hill College. This program is paid for by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations in Daphne and in Malbus with the state-of-the-art car wash. Good morning, Dr. Lou.
Well, good morning to you, Lori, and I want to thank you for pre-recording this since I have a schedule conflict. I'm supposed to be speaking about critical race theory to the Mobile Board of Education, so we had to do this morning.
So you will be speaking to that board as this show is playing here on WABF.
You got it. Okay. So that's what we're doing. So listen, folks, as usual, we always have all sorts of things to talk about. I mean, I could talk about, you know, Biden's pathetic speech at the UN. We could talk about the continuing deterioration of the border. We could talk about election reform, election integrity, and the fact that Secretary Merrill has now decided to have an election reform panel. All right, so unfortunately, I can't do that today, because what I want to do is talk about how China has become such a real threat to everything that we think about in terms of how the United States should be, whether domestically or internationally. And I want to do this within the frame of how the fact of the matter is that Biden's weakness and his policy failures, particularly Afghanistan, I think have started to make the Chinese think very seriously about doing what they have wanted to do for many, many years, which is to take Taiwan. That could very well lead to a major war. At least in theory it could, because we have a relationship with the Taiwanese. We have offered to protect them for many, many years. So in order for us to understand all of this, I've asked Lieutenant Commander Deke Cox to come back on the radio. You remember Deke from a few weeks ago? We were talking about the whole Afghanistan, you know, debacle. And as I explained to you then, he has over 30 years of experience in naval intelligence. He retired after about 8 combat tours. He is an individual who understands China. That was his major specialty. He speaks Chinese. And so for me to try to educate you all, the best thing for me to do is to invite Deke back. So Deke, you're here. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it.
Welcome.
Hey, thank you. Hey, Laurie. Hey, Dr. Lou.
Well, we may have to do this more than once, because in half an hour, we got a lot to cover.
All right.
So let's start. Let me frame this for the audience. Basically, what I wanted to try to do today was to give you all an understanding of what China's military capability is, given how it's risen over the last 20 years especially. And then secondly, I wanted to try to see if Deke could tease out what the short-term intentions that he sees going on with China. So let's just start it off with the military aspects of this. Deke, you know, your thoughts on what's going on with all that, and what are we most concerned about, particularly as it relates to our Pacific Fleet and what we normally can see as our most likely approach to dealing with China through sea power.
Sure. So sea power underpins America's economic prosperity, and not just America, but the world. Okay. The world is still 75% water, or you know, 75% water, and it takes you know, navies of consequence to be able to stand in and maintain economic prosperity. China's emergent People's Liberation Army Navy, also known as the PLAN, has been undergoing rapid modernization, mostly with a lot of stolen technology from the United States and our most technological partners. But they have between their standing regular Navy, their Coast Guard, heavily armed Coast Guard militias, and what we call their Little Blue Men, which is their maritime militia forces that they put together, their irregulars, they can muster up thousands of ships. And when it comes to combatants, they now have more tonnage and better armed combatants. You know, for instance, the new Type 55, you know, heavy destroyer, guided missile destroyer, it's actually called the Stealth Guided Missile Destroyer, you know, comes in at 13,000 tons, and that far outweighs, you know, an Arleigh Burke-class cruiser or destroyer, which is, you know, know, the mainstay of the U.S. Navy surface fleet.
Mm-hmm.
They've also made tremendous gains in submarine technologies and submarine warfare. And, you know, and again, we're seeing them field aircraft carriers. And so, you know, they've done this through hook and crook. You know, I was actually in the Strait of Dardanelles over in the Eastern Mediterranean back in 2001 when the then Ukrainian CV Varyag, which was a late Russian-built aircraft carrier
mm-hmm.
that did not get finished before the Soviet Union collapsed, was purchased through a business front, a Chinese business front, and then sold to the Chinese, and they took it around, you know, the Cape and brought it into China
mm-hmm.
under the guise of turning it into a park, you know, an entertainment
right.
park. Well, they didn't do that. They took it straight into Dalian Shipyard up in the north of China, and it sat there, and then they were going through that thing inch by inch to figure out how to make it better and overhaul it, and now it's in the fleet as CV-1.
Right.
So, you know, they've got two other carriers under construction, and we think that their third carrier is actually going to have a technology known as EMALS, and that's going to allow the use of electromagnetic force to actually be able to launch and recover aircraft. And
mm-hmm.
so this is, you know, these are, you know, they're trying to make generational leaps in technology to, you know, to outdo any peer competitor like the United States.
Right.
The reason why we go into that level of detail, Dr. Liu, is because we have to understand that what animates the Chinese is this century of humiliation. Okay,
mm-hmm.
they think that, you know, that their rightful place is as lords of the Middle Kingdom, what they refer to as the Middle Kingdom and everything under the sky, and they are trying very hard. When you hear Xi Jinping talk about the rejuvenation of China, this is what he's talking about. It animates the Communist Party. It animates everything that they do. When you look at their history from the very founding, you know, even if you know, just kind of put aside their 20 year plus civil war
mm-hmm.
aside when they beat the nationalists and they fled to Taiwan, when you put that aside, the Communist Chinese almost right away from the time that they won the civil war began a campaign of expansion. They do this through a technique known as salami slicing, and you know, it's like watching a fish take your bait, right? They'll nibble
mm-hmm.
nibble and they'll take over an area. First it was Tibet, and then they did Inner Mongolia, and then a whole range. They started a raging border war with Vietnam in 1979, and then, you know, active in the Spratlys. And you know, when you're standing there and you look, it appears like, oh, well, you know, they just took a little bit of territory, or now we have a Chinese presence, you know, on an outpost. You know, they've done it to India, right on the border with India.
Yeah, the 1962 war over, and now there's still this whole question of the border.
That's right. Now,
not major, but the skirmishes
right.
have been there, and they continue to.
They're contrived fight. And they're intentional.
Yeah.
Okay, and so then when you look at the South China Sea, for instance, they started by taking one island, and then, you know, they began an aggressive campaign back about 12 or 13 years ago to actually militarize them and build them out into
right.
significant fortifications down in the South China Sea where you can harbor big warships and planes
right.
and, you know, I mean, it's a world-class facility that you know, they have on several of the islands down in the South China Sea. So when we look at, you know, their overarching belief, you know, what animates them in their geopolitical strategy and the way that they've poured, you know, trillions of dollars into advancing, you know, their Navy in particular, but then, you know, they've got something that we really don't have an answer for, which is their missile forces, right? China has always invested heavily in missile technology, and they are world-class. They do the closest, you know, certainly are the Russians and then the United States, but China completely outclasses us in missile technology. And, you know, just this past month, you know, we've had new intelligence, you know, come out in open source reporting
mm-hmm.
where the Chinese are building 300 intercontinental ballistic missile silos, you know, to force strategic deterrence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's kind of in your face. They're not interested in deterrence on anybody. You know, they're right there with their normal bully tactics.
Can I just ask you
sure.
real quick? I know that there were discussions during the Clinton administration about advanced ballistic missile defenses, okay? And it has always been an issue. I mean, they poo-pooed Reagan's Star Wars and, you know, things like that. But is it your sense that with China doing the kinds of things it's doing, particularly with ICBMs, that we have an adequate defense to prevent those long-range missiles from hitting the United States?
Yeah, so the long-term answer on that has always been Aegis. And so we have, you know, Aegis destroyers, those are the Arleigh Burkes and the cruisers. But that technology, you know, was fielded first in the 1970s, and it is now mm-hmm. dated. Now it has seen significant upgrades and updates. You mentioned the Iron Dome technology that Israel uses to keep Hezbollah missiles at bay and Iranian missiles at bay. But the real challenge here, Dr. Liu, is that, you know, it's a problem of time and distance, and the fact that these are forward deployed naval forces for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And while we do have friends and China has none, okay, let's be very clear about that. China has no friends, okay, and we have Japan, and we have treaty obligations with Japan. We have treaty obligations with, you know, the Philippines mm-hmm. and Thailand and you know, others, and we just formed a new
association with
the UK and Australia,
right.
You know, that will provide the Australians with nuclear submarines. But when it comes to missiles at sea, you know, going back to the PLA rocket force, right? So mm-hmm. the PLA rocket force is, you know, they have the DF-21 and the DF-26, and you know, what we know from public sourcing on intel and analysis is that they, you know, for 20 years they've been practicing against, you know, mock-ups of U.S. aircraft carriers mm-hmm. and are the base of, you know, the United States 7th Fleet at Yokosuka, Japan. You know, they've been practicing against mock-ups of, you know, those two particular targets.
Mm-hmm.
They have capabilities in these mid-range and long-range ballistic missiles, which have MIRVs, multiple reentry vehicles, that are hypersonic, right? Supersonic to hypersonic, mm-hmm. and they, when they come in on reentry, you know, they have shown, they've demonstrated that, you know, these missiles can be accurate enough to be able to do at least a soft kill on almost any maritime force that enters into the near seas, okay? The east, you know, if you're approaching the second island chain, the first island chain, somewhere in there, they can hit you at standoff. And that is a real problem for us, because for years the United States was a signatory to the, mm-hmm. To the IBF treaty, and that's the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, Intermediate Ballistic Missile Force convention that kept us from developing intermediate range missiles,
right?
Such as an extended range Tomahawk, you know, or other types of hypersonics.
Yeah, just to put it in context, this is because we wanted to kind of slow down the Russians' ability to do that, because the NATO forces would be, you know, overwhelmed with all sorts of, you know, intermediate range missiles.
That's
so
right.
So we did that. But again, notice how that kind of fell apart too with Trump, because he said, well, look, the Soviets are cheating on it, or the Russians are cheating on it. We're not going to re-sign it. But clearly, the fact that we didn't have the Chinese in it is a major problem today.
Right. The Chinese are experts at exploiting gaps and weaknesses. And this is something that is... It's articulated well by, Kerry Gershanik, you know, Dr. Kerry Gershanik, who's a retired Colonel Marines mm-hmm. in Taiwan. And, you know, he speaks often about political warfare, which is one of the PRC's three warfarers doctrine. Mm-hmm. But he's also done some work with Captain Jim Fennell, who was my former boss and who I continue to work with. And he is the former head of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. And it's interesting that, you know, when you look at it what the Chinese non-signatory status on that treaty meant, it meant that they were free to continue to develop very high-end technologies in the intermediate and long-range mm-hmm. Rocket force, and now it's gotten so severe that, you know, our forces have atrophied, okay, and shriveled up to where, you know, a few years ago we only had the subsonic Tomahawk cruise missile and a, you know, 40-year-old version of the Harpoon anti-ship missile
mm-hmm.
and, you know, no supersonic capable missiles, nothing that we can shoot back and kill, you know, bad guy ships with. And that's a real problem. You know, when you're trying to fight, and you have to be held at arm's distance because, you know, or further because you can't get inside the enemy's operating area, you know, they've effectively won, right?
Yeah.
If you can't come into a what's known as a 50-77 scenario, which is a defensive Taiwan scenario, and you can't come in and render aid and deliver air power and deliver Marines on the shores to reinforce, you know, what will surely be a rapidly overwhelmed Taiwanese defense, you know, it's a real problem, you know, and if you try going into that, you know, environment, you know, mm-hmm. where it's kinetic, it's gone kinetic, and they've got the rocket force shooting at you, and they've got hundreds of missiles to our one or two, you know, that we can get off. It, you know, it's a complete lopsided equation that you're just not going to come out on the winning side of that, right? And so, you know, then you haven't even talked, you know, we haven't even begun to talk about their anti-ship missiles that are on like their Hubei PTG, which, by the way, you know, were sold to them. Those plans were sold to them by an Australian shipbuilding company known as Austal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, it's a very layered problem, Lou.
Well, let me ask you this, though. I mean, in terms of trying to provide, you know, a deterrence against the Chinese and their desire to take Taiwan, and I know we're focusing on this, but this question of anti-ship missiles, I mean, we've seen this before in the Iran-Iraq war. One of our destroyers was hit with a French missile. So it's something that we have got to be very, very careful about. But it seems to me what you're saying is that, well, let me ask you this. In terms of anti-ship missiles, what sort of capabilities do we have on our ships right now to handle that? My understanding was that we do have some systems that can take care of that.
Right. So the United States Navy's system is centered around the Standard Missile Series, okay? Mm-hmm. And what you see in our cruiser and destroyer fleet, what's left of it, is the SM-2 and SM-3, okay? But there are other variants that have been pitched and contracted, developed, and sold, you know, through the acquisition process to the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're now up to the, you know, SM-6 and other variants. And so that offer, those missiles have been proven, you know, in what we call tactical ballistic missile drills, TBM drills, and you know, they've done well, okay,
mm-hmm.
to be clear. You know, we talk a lot about what China has, okay, their strategy for how they would actually employ that is, some of that remains to be seen. We understand, you know, surely, you know, that they, you know, that they continue to get better and better and better with each passing day.
Right.
It doesn't mean that the United States Navy or the United States Joint Forces have been completely outclassed, but, you know, it's very clear that we now have a peer competitor. They certainly have more ships than we do, and they're bigger, better, newer. And, you know, the edge that the United States Navy probably once had with, you know, the early series Standard Missile, you know,
mm-hmm.
to provide tactical defense, you know, against both tactical threats for incoming, but then also strategic threats such as, you know, a DF-21 or DF-26 or other missile that
mm-hmm.
may be coming from North Korea or some other, you know, Chinese silo somewhere, you know, that the Standard Missile Series can successfully track and engage those missiles. We also have, you know, I was in Okinawa back in 2005, 2006 when the U.S. Army deployed the first Patriot missile batteries around
mm-hmm.
Kadena Air Base, you know, and so, you know, we have the Patriot system as well as the Standard Missile system on our shipborne platforms, and, you know, they are, you know, high quality systems, you know, make no mistake. The real challenge, Lou, is that it's just a problem of numbers.
Right.
And, you know, there are other technologies that have been looked at, but, you know, because the United States acquisition system, you know, defense acquisition
right.
system is such a nightmare, and, you know, just bleeds billions and billions of dollars, you know, out of the, you know,
the budget.
Yeah, the budget mm-hmm. and our ability to deliver systems, you know, on time that work. You know, it's a real problem. You know, we've got to you know, look and be thankful that the previous administration worked on the extended range. You know, they brought the extended range Tomahawk back
mm-hmm.
and they're looking at some other systems, you know, to rapidly deploy. And when you're building missile systems, it's not like we're starting from scratch, you
right.
know. Plus, like we said, you know, we have other, you know, highly capable allies, the Japanese key among them, the Australians. You know, they're also investing in some of these technologies, and you know, it's very healthy to see the Japanese kind of coming out of their long-term self-constraint, you know, that they were bound constitutionally up until about 20 years ago.
MacArthur,
and then politically, you know, only until the last year or two, you know, again, in concert and at the encouragement of the Trump administration, where the Japanese, you know, have finally started to, you know, come out of their political self-imposed exile,
right.
You know, and come back out and you know, increase their defense spending and develop technologies that are going to complement, you know, the joint force and any coalition that we would absolutely need to be able to push back on Chinese invasion.
Well, I mean, I think I've sort of asked you to concentrate on what's going on with the on the naval side of this,
mm-hmm.
Mainly because the Navy is going to be the first there, and it's going to provide the means by which we can either save Taiwan or not save Taiwan. So given that, can you sort of take us to a more strategic version or a strategic view of what they're thinking, not so much for intentions, but I do want to get to intentions, but just kind of put their strategic thinking into, you know, a broader view so that people understand how they possibly think about all these things. We're thinking about it in terms of a specific, you know, how do we deter them from Taiwan, which I think is very important.
Mm-hmm.
It's important that we deter them from different things. But what is their thinking that we need to kind of get a grip on?
Sure. So, again, we talked about what animates them strategically, which is their idea of atoning or accounting for the century of humiliation,
mm-hmm.
Okay, when Western powers and colonial powers invaded them, and that includes Japanese occupation in some of their coastal areas back in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at where they're going now, okay, it is a rejuvenation. It's the great national rejuvenation is what you'll hear Xi Jinping refer to it, right? And again, you know, folks, remember this man is a dictator and a murderous one at that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is a product of the bloody Cultural Revolution where, the Chinese under Mao Zedong, you know, killed, you know, upwards of 100 million of his countrymen, you know, over, you know, 20 or 30 years of his reign. They are a bloody dictatorial regime, and when you look at what they have in mind, you know, their Ministry of Foreign Affairs lies wholesale, but you look at what they've done in Hong Kong, okay, look at what they've done in Xinjiang, look at what they've done in Tibet, and what animates them is within this idea of the Middle Kingdom, a restoration of the Middle Kingdom and all under the sun, they are absolutely convinced that their destiny, okay, their destiny is to be the global hegemon, to supplant and replace the United States of America and to become the power in the world. It's what animates them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when, you know, and they have a very long-term strategy. They've been at this for about 40 years, and their strategy is comprehensive, and so when we look at salami slicing, when we look at, you know, what animates them, a big thing that sticks in their craw is that they have never been able to consolidate and, quote, restore the island of Taiwan, which they never, ever controlled, okay? Not a single day under any Chinese empire.
Right.
No Chinese empire and certainly the Chinese Communist Party, you know, have ever had troops on Taiwan. They've never controlled Taiwan. You know, it was never a part of, you know, original Chinese territory. And so, you know, it's a bad argument for the Communist Chinese to say that they're going to invade and restore or forcibly reunite, you know, Taiwan. It's a lie.
Right.
And has no historical precedence, and you know, they've tried several times, the Taiwan Strait crises back in the 1950s, where
mm-hmm.
they put Taiwan and its outlying islands under extensive continuous bombardment. for months, and the, you know, the Taiwanese did have to fall back off of a couple of the islands that were closer to Fujian province,
mm-hmm.
you know, but they were able to, you know, keep the Chinese at bay then. That is probably not going to happen now, okay? It's you know, it's one of those things where, again, time, distance, and size matters, because when you look at Chinese amphibious forces, when you look at their airborne capability, their paratroops, the way that they would attack the Taiwanese problem, you know, militarily, you know, would just be a sheer overwhelming force. You know, it would probably right. start with a missile bombardment and then be followed up at whatever cost. You know, the Chinese don't care what it costs them once they commit. And they would throw everything in the kitchen sink at Taiwan, its outlying islands. You might see it start with a island grab, you know, where they would go down.
Yeah, Koimoi and Matsu are natural ones.
That's right.
I mean, Eisenhower had to deploy the 7th Fleet to neutralize that back in 1959, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, sir, that's right. And so, you know, it could be that they try and take, you know, Taiwan's Seoul Island, you know, mm-hmm. with a nice airstrip down in the Spratly Islands. It may be that they go after Matsui, you know,
yeah.
As a show of force, because they... If you read their political warfare doctrine, you know, again, as Professor Gershanik, you know, lays it out, and he's done so with Captain Fennell as well, is that, you know, they prefer to win without fighting. You know, they get, you know, the Chinese approach, you know, as we say, the Chinese play Go and mm-hmm. we play chess. Okay, mm-hmm. chess is a challenging game, but I promise you, Go, which is a traditional Chinese strategic game, is 100 times harder than chess, and they play it in sport. And so,
right.
you know, we use that to put this in context, that, you know, that look at what they've done. You know, look at their actions. Don't listen to what they say, because if their lips are moving, they're lying. Okay,
right.
but
mm-hmm.
look at what they've done in their salami slicing, in the build out of their forces, in their political warfare and information warfare environment, and the way that they are shaping the battlefield continuously. They use a whole of government approach, Dr. Liu. We've talked mm-hmm. about this a little bit before, but they use a whole of government approach, and we don't. You know, and it's time that we get back to that. If you look back at the way the United States effectively countered the Soviet Union, it was a whole of government approach. And Kerry Gershanik does an outstanding job in his book from last year called Political Warfare,
right.
China's Plan to Win Without Fighting. And he does a really good job of outlining, you know, the full whole of government approach that the Communist Party of China is taking and has successfully employed against the United States and really any nation worldwide that they felt that they needed to go after Chinese interests there.
So, Deke, this whole business of political warfare, kind of fill in a few, give us a few examples of how this is working out. I know, like, the Confucius centers and things like that, but tell everyone, you know, what exactly they're doing that makes us compromised.
Sure. So, Lori actually hit the key point at the break, you know, which is through companies like Blackstone and other, you know, houses, investment houses in Wall Street, is that they're, you know, Hyde Street in London, you know, the Chinese have been successful for decades in completely infiltrating these large investment houses and converting Western capital, you know, mostly dollars, to investment capital, also known as foreign direct investment and bond investments, that sort of thing. And, you know, anybody who's watched Chinese markets knows that it's a shell game. You know, it's a complete Ponzi scheme. They've got a whole separate shadow banking system. They've kept they've never really truly liberalized their banking system to keep our investment bankers out. And what that does is it gives them unprecedented power to be able to just suck up and sponge up foreign money, especially from places like the United States, and then turn it to its nefarious purposes. You know, and so there's a whole another radio show or two or three or ten that we could
right.
do just on Blackstone and investments. But let's look at the Thrift Savings Plan. Okay. The highly successful retirement savings plan that is pitched to all federal employees and the U.S. military. And just under, you know, just 2-3 years ago under the last administration, we had to fight off a plan to open up thrift savings plan to invest wholesale in China. It is a huge pot of money. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's one key example that you can see where the Chinese were actively trying to encourage, you know, TSP to invest in China. And part of this is, one, they're just craven lust and greed, okay, to go after piles of money. And then the second is that it's absolute political subversion, which if they can tie your federal employee retirement plan and for the military to their economy, then what success would you ever have extricating yourself from that, right? Yeah. It you know,
no more sanctions.
No more sanctions, your interest or their interest, okay? And so, you know, President Trump did not get the credit that he deserved, you know, for stopping that. And, you know, I think that we need to recognize that that is still at risk. It's still in play. And there are far too many people at the very top of, you know, the current administration and throughout the U.S. federal government that still think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just wrong.
And, I mean, linked to all of that is this whole question of their spying. I understand that FBI has close to 5,000 open cases in terms of Chinese spying. We've seen it, the infiltration in Congress with, you know, congressman who's got the Chinese...
Eric Swalwell.
Yeah, Swalwell, yeah. With the, mm-hmm. the gal.
Well, Dianne Feinstein, you know,
and Feinstein
Mitch
having her driver, yeah. And then, so you've got all of these kinds of things. So I guess, folks, if you're just joining us, I mean, we're kind of at the end of this. You know, Lieutenant Commander Cox has this unbelievable experience in terms of being an intelligence officer in the Navy for over 30 years in terms of watching China. So what we're suggesting to you here is that China is a threat, okay? The last thing I would like to ask you to do is just evaluate, if you could, briefly, since we're getting close to the end, your sense of what their short-term intentions might be vis-a-vis this issue of Taiwan, which we've been talking about as something that they really want. I mean, the analogy that comes to my mind, and we had talked about this, was this whole business of what the Hanoi did, taking a province in December of 74 as a prelude to what they were going to do. So quickly, just kind of give us a brief thumbnail sketch of what you think is going to happen here.
Well, I think that, you know, Captain Fennell says it best. He enunciated, or, you know, laid out a plan for, you know, what he thought was Communist China's plan for Taiwan. And it's, you know, it was this decade of concern, you know, beginning, he assessed that, you know, beginning by the late 2000s into the early 2020s, which is where we are now, that we would be entering a decade of concern where Communist China would have the overwhelming preponderance of forces and power, you know, and will have been able to successfully shape the information environment here in the United States to a point where we would even, you know, and look at the house plant that's in the White House right now, okay?
Right.
Where he's completely bought out as the Manchurian candidate, and they've got their man. Okay, they've got their man exactly where they want him and his entire administration. And so, you know, when you look at how they have successfully shaped the international environment and in here in the States, it, you know, that they could go ahead and make a move on Taiwan tomorrow and we probably wouldn't come to Taiwan's defense. Okay, and that is heartbreaking especially when you look at just 9 months ago with the previous administration and where they were with Taiwan.
Right. Well, folks, I mean, we're painting a dismal picture, but it's entirely predicated on Joe Biden's compromised situation with China, taking all the money and their family, and his unbelievably poor decisions in terms of, you know, foreign policy. And the latest example is Afghanistan. Deke, if you could, real quickly, tell us what's going on locally that's important to you in terms of this mask mandate that we've been working on.
Sure. Well, the segue that I'm going to give you is an offer to the audience is that, you know, right here in Alabama, we have a problem with Chinese money as well. And you got to look at Secretary of State Merrill and his backing of the Golden Dragon copper tubing plant in Wilcox County and his multiple trips to Communist China with his assistant Ying Spring Na Zhao. And you know, that's something that voters and the constituents need to be taking a very hard look at. And when you look at Governor Ivey being from Wilcox County and, you know, some of the, you know, likely nefarious dealings that were done to bring Golden Dragon to Alabama and other communist companies, you know, that we need to clean house here. Okay, another thing that we're doing here is we're doing Friday Night Lights. Operation Friday Night Lights, folks, is an invitation to everyone in this listening area to come out to your local home football games in Baldwin County, and we're going to be putting on an advertising campaign to put pressure on the Baldwin County Board of Education to rescind their mask mandate. There's no reason that our children should be wearing masks for, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day. And the scientific evidence and the evidence in practice is overwhelming that masks don't work as implemented, and that, you know, we've got private schools in the county that have never had a mask mandate, and their numbers are way better than Baldwin County's.
Well, Deke, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it. You're right. We're going to have to come back and talk more about this. Miss Lori, as always,
fascinating.
Great host.
I wish I could let you go on for
hours. I understand it. Well, maybe I'll just have to pay more. That's all we have to do.
Buy more radio time.
That's right.
That's right.
So listen, folks, this is an important conversation. We will be back on the 4th of October, I think. That's our next time. Okay.
See you then.
See you then. Y'all take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campo-Minosi, president of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. This program is paid for by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations in Daphne and the one in Malbus with a state-of-the-art car wash. We now resume regular programming. If you missed this show or want to tell a friend, you can listen to it later at WABF1480.com.